Welcome everyone to this program on direct oral anticoagulants in patients with venous thromboembolism and obesity. My name is Rachel Rosowski and I'm a hematologist at the Massachusetts General Hospital, an associate professor at Harvard Medical School, and I am thrilled to be presenting this topic to you with my colleague and friend Stefan Moll, who is a hematologist and professor of medicine at the University of North Carolina School of Medicine. Welcome everyone. Here are my disclosures. So for the time we have, we're hoping to share with you briefly the scope of the problem and then really delve into the topic of DOACs, direct oral anticoagulants, VTE, venous thromboembolism, and obesity, review the old guidelines, talk about new guidelines, and how they relate to bariatric surgery, and end with some ongoing challenges and evidence gaps. And it's estimated from the CDC that each year in the United States, 900,000 men, women, and children will suffer from a VTE every year, and as many as 100,000 people will die of a VTE. That is one person every 6 minutes. And this problem is not going away. So obesity is defined by weight and BMI. So BMI, or body mass index, is a measure of an adult's weight in relation to his or her height, calculated by using the adult's weight in kilograms divided by the square of his or her height in meters. So just a few definitions. Obesity is considered a BMI of greater than 30 kilograms per meter squared, and severe obesity is a BMI of greater than 40 kilograms per meter squared. We know that obesity is a major epidemic and public health problem that's reaching crisis proportion. Now, to show you this in a more visual way, you can see here the prevalence of self-reported obesity among U.S. adults by state and territory starting in 2011, where the green is less than 25% of the state is obese, yellow is between 25 to 30% obese, orange is 30 to 40% are obese, and red, which you can't even, there's no state that has red in 2011, indicates that the prevalence of self-reported obesity is greater than 40%. And watch how the prevalence changes over time. 2011, 2016, and 2021. There is only one green state and a handful of yellow states, indicating a significant increase in the prevalence of obesity in every state over time. We know obesity affects more than 650 million adults worldwide. And as I showed you, no state or territory right now has a prevalence of obesity less than 20%. Now, in terms of anticoagulation, the direct oral anticoagulants are now widely used as first-line treatment for the treatment and prevention of VTE based on several studies that have demonstrated that they are as effective as warfarin for preventing recurrent blood clots, but they all have better safety profiles, meaning less bleeding. However, there's great uncertainty regarding their efficacy and safety in patients with obesity. So in 2016, the International Society of Thrombosis and Hemostasis published a guidance document surrounding the use of DOACs in obese patients with VTE and then updated these guidance in 2021. So Dr. Moll, can you give us a summary of the old 2016 ISTH guidance document on the use of DOAC in obesity, and in particular, the severe obese patients, and then what is now new in the recent 2021 ISTH guidelines?
We'd be happy to do that. Thank you for having me on this program. So I'll make it simple. I'll talk about the BMI above 40 as a severe obesity, which some people call extreme obesity, but often it's also considered a weight of more than 120 kilos. And in 2016, a group of mostly hematologists international came together and discussed what are the data on these very obese patients for the use of DOACs. Now, in the clinical trials, often patients have been enrolled that were simply obese, i.e. BMI above 30, 35, but the patients in the trials that were with a BMI of more than 40 were really uncommon or were not reported. But at that time, there were very limited data on the use of the DOACs in the severely obese patients, i.e. these body weights. So given those limitations, the recommendation in 2016 was to avoid the DOACs in the severely obese patients and use warfarin instead. And that was because it was not clear whether peaks and troughs and area under the curve, i.e. the DOAC exposure, how it behaved in the severely obese patients. And it was from that time that often people avoided the use of DOACs, at least in the severely obese patients, but sometimes even in the less severe obese patients, i.e. the ones with a BMI between 30 and 40. Now that document in 2016 was followed, which was nice to see, by a number of studies and sub-analyses trying to answer the question, so how do the DOACs really behave in the severely obese patients so that we have some clinical guidance? And that prompted this working group to bring out a new guidance document in 2021, which is now 1.5 years in circulation. And I want to talk about these this statement and how it refers to our severely obese patients. And I've listed here the publication in the Journal of Thrombosis and Hemostasis and the authors, and I want to highlight that this was an international working group from Germany, the US, Holland, and Norway. And as you see, I'm the senior author on this, so I'm well familiar with the background work that went into it and the final recommendations. And in the paper, if you pull it from PubMed or wherever you have access to, there are 6 points that we recommend. And I will take them a little apart to make them easier to see here on the slides. So first of all, we're dealing with venous thromboembolism. All of us are hematologists. We did not review the literature on AFib, even though many of us are somewhat familiar with it. But we wanted to focus on the use of DOACs in severely obese patients with VTE. So here you see that for the treatment of VTE now, based on the 2021 guidance, the use of all DOACs is reasonable, even in the severely obese patients. Now, given, up to a BMI of 40, the use of any of the DOACs is reasonable. However, above the BMI of 40, or weight of 120 kilos and above, Rivaroxaban and apixaban are reasonable to choose. Then not enough data on dabigatran or edoxaban, so the guidance group recommended or suggested not to use dabigatran or edoxaban in the severely obese patients. Now, the one thing in 2021 I want to highlight, in the severely obese patients at that time, there were more data on rivaroxaban than on apixaban. So my preference up until 2021 was to use rivaroxaban in the severely obese patients. But in the last 1.5 years, there have been additional data on apixaban, sub-analyses and studies, retrospective studies, that have supported the use of apixaban in the severely obese patients. Now, the guidance group suggests not to use regularly peak or trough level drug levels to determine them. That changed compared to 2016. At this point, it's a regular dose that is to be used in the severely obese patients without checking peak or trough. And then some of you may wonder about the use of the DOACs in DVT prophylaxis, in the primary DVT prophylaxis, and can we use the DOACs in the severely obese patients? The suggestion is that the standard dosing be used for apixaban and rivaroxaban regardless of the BMI and weight. So in any of the BMIs and weight groups to use rivaroxaban or apixaban. There are insufficient data on dabigatran and edoxaban for VT prophylaxis in the severely obese patients. And for those of you who are interested a little more in the details, and this is in the ISTH guidance document and you can look at that, it really talks about the pharmacokinetic and pharmacodynamic data on these drugs, which are somewhat limited in the severely obese patients. And on the left, you see how the PK data and the PD data behave in apixaban, dabigatran, and rivaroxaban with increasing body weight or increasing BMI. And you see comments there like lower peak, lower area under the curve, or no change, lower peak, a variety of different changes in the PK and PD data, and it has been somewhat challenging to translate that into clinical efficacy because with the DOACs, we all have such a we see such a wide variation in serum drug levels, even in normal individuals, that it's difficult to really correlate it to clinical efficacy unless you look at prospective, randomized, good clinical trials. And how these drugs behave in the phase 3 and phase 4 clinical trials, we've listed here in the table B on the right-hand side. And again, you have apixaban, dabigatran, edoxaban, rivaroxaban listed in the different rows. In the phase 3, i.e. the randomized comparison trials of the DOACs versus vitamin K in the severely obese patients, BMI above 40, you see in red that there are no prospective data specifically for this patient population on any of the DOACs, which is a limitation and has given this hesitancy initially to use the DOACs in the severely obese patients. Now, there are data in the less severe patients, BMI 35, 40, and you see them that with rivaroxaban, you have similar outcomes. The other ones are listed as no data. But then if you look at the phase 4 clinical trials, which are the post-FDA approval studies, typically retrospective or claims database data, you see that for the severely obese patients, BMI above 40, for apixaban, there's similar outcomes between warfarin and apixaban, and with rivaroxaban, similar outcomes as well in DVT and PE. And this has led to the recommendation that even in the severely obese patients, it is reasonable to use apixaban and rivaroxaban. And as Dr. Rosofsky, Rachel, you said earlier, from a safety point of view, often the drugs have an advantage over warfarin, thus similar efficacy and sometimes better safety, but there are no data on dabigatran and edoxaban in the severely obese patients. So with that, I think we can maybe turn to a clinical question. And Rachel, let's just be practical. We are both hematologists. Yeah. We see patients with DVT and PE. Imagine you have a patient who's, let's say, 64 years old, has a newly diagnosed, unprovoked DVT or PE, proximal DVT, needs treatment, weighs 135 kilos, and the body mass index is 44.6, so severely obese. Creatinine is normal, platelets are normal, you're not concerned about bleeding, but severely obese. What anticoagulant would you use, and what is your thought process?
So I think as you have just shown us, there's now good evidence that supports the use of direct oral anticoagulants, and in particular, rivaroxaban and apixaban in obese patients. And for this patient with a BMI over 40, which as you said would be considered severe obesity, I would feel entirely comfortable prescribing either rivaroxaban or apixaban. And as you suggested, even though the 2021 guidelines noted that there is less supportive data with use of apixaban, since that publication there's been additional data that have shown that looking at the efficacy and safety of both rivaroxaban and apixaban in patients with obesity. And in fact, there's been over 15 studies, many of them single center retrospective, some of them multi-center and a few observational. And there's actually been 3 systematic reviews and meta-analyses. So I think there is now as much data for apixaban as there is for rivaroxaban. And therefore I would use either one, and I would use the FDA approved doses. So for rivaroxaban, that would be 15 milligrams twice a day for 21 days, and then 20 milligrams daily after that. And it's important, as you know, to tell patients to take rivaroxaban with food. And then, as I said, I would feel entirely comfortable prescribing the apixaban based on what you just shared. And that would be 10 milligrams twice a day for the first 7 days, and then 5 milligrams twice a day thereafter. And I just want to point out the importance of knowing the correct dose. Both you and I are hematologists, and we prescribe these drugs all the time. But I think if you're a healthcare provider and you're not someone that prescribes these a lot or routinely, I would encourage people to confirm the dose, because we know patients that are put on incorrect doses have higher rates of complications such as recurrent clots and bleeds. And as you shared already, there's not enough data for dabigatran or edoxaban, and therefore I would not feel comfortable using either one of those drugs in this situation.
Rachel, Would you see any role to do a peak or trough level in this patient with a BMI of 44 or so where you want to use a DOAC?
So I think in line with the guidance documents you just mentioned, for this patient with a BMI of 44, I would not check peak or trough levels, and I would feel entirely comfortable not doing that. What about you?
Yeah,
Feel
I would do
similar?
the same.
Good.
And then a question that comes up not infrequently is, what about at 6 months based on the Einstein Choice Trial or the Amplify Extension trials where patients with DVT-PE after 6 months were lowered in their dose to the more prophylactic dose, and those were found to be effective in both those studies in the population studied, which had limited numbers of severely obese patients, if any. We don't know that for sure. What would you do in the more severely obese patient, the BMI above 40? Would you lower the dose at 6 months?
So I would say, I mean, just take a step back in terms of how long this person needs to be treated with anticoagulation, because you mentioned this was an unprovoked blood clot. I think if she has low bleeding risk, this is someone that I absolutely would recommend long-term anticoagulation. That's based on a number of studies that have shown patients with unprovoked VTE who stop their anticoagulant are at a very high risk of recurrent clots. Some studies up to 25% at 5 years, others up to 50% over 10 years. So I absolutely would do long term. And just as you mentioned, there's two trials, one with rivaroxaban and one with apixaban, that have demonstrated that after that 6 to 12 months of therapeutic anticoagulation, it is both safe and effective to decrease these drugs to a prophylactic dose. However, I don't think there is enough data in the obese population to practice this, and I would therefore not decrease the dose at the 6 month mark in this patient. And that decision is in line with the ISTH guidance from 2021 that you just shared with us, and that states that it is not possible to provide evidence-based guidance on DOAC dose reduction following the initial 6 months of full dose treatment, owing to insufficient data. I mean, there's just no dedicated data or analyses specifically looking at dose reduction for patients with severe obesity. But I also think it's important to point out that in those two studies where patients were randomized to stay on therapeutic dose, decreased to a prophylactic dose, and in both trials, as you know, there was a third arm. In the rivaroxaban trial, the third arm was aspirin, and in the apixaban trial, the third arm was a placebo. There was no statistically significant difference in major bleeding rates. And to me, that is reassuring to keep my obese patients on the therapeutic dose long term if it's indicated.
Yeah, I have the same clinical approach. In the severely obese patients, BMI above 40, I would not lower the dose at 6 months. In the patients with a BMI between 30 and 40, I might consider it, but I wouldn't rush into it either.
Yeah, I would do the same. I think BMI 30 to 40, and it also depends if they have other risk factors, right? So if they have more than just obesity as a risk factor, I'd be more inclined to keep them on the higher dose.
Yes. Well, then let's imagine the patient who is really at the extreme body weight end with a BMI of 61, who had an acute DVT of PE. Would you feel comfortable using a DOAC in that patient? And would your consideration of peak or trough level testing change with that really extreme body weight?
Yeah. So I would say, and I think we might differ here, in patients who are extremely obese, i.e. BMI greater than 60, I mean, I think the issue with the ISTH guidance, which I think is great, they don't state an upper limit for which DOACs should not be considered. And although somewhat arbitrary, I would have some reservations in a BMI greater than 60. And this is not based on any evidence-based data. And I know there are several more limitations with warfarin. So it's really a conversation I would have with a patient. But I would say my first choice, I think with a BMI over 60 in this particular patient, would probably be warfarin. But if the patient were really averse to that, I would consider either rivaroxaban or apixaban. But unlike the patient with a BMI of 44, if I were going to prescribe rivaroxaban or apixaban, I would absolutely check plasma DOAC levels, and specifically, I would check trough levels. But I would also acknowledge that the DOAC drug levels do not have good or proven correlation to clinical efficacy and safety. And so if the trough level were too low, I would not adjust the DOAC level to a non-FDA approved dose, as there's really no guidance for that or evidence for that. So if I did check it and it was not within range, I would just change to another agent, likely warfarin. So I'm interested. I think you probably have a little bit different opinion. So what do you think?
Well, the guidance document from the ICH could not comment on a cutoff of weight where you get more concerned or you think about different management because we just don't have the data. So it was left open on purpose. So that's really left up to each individual physician then to consider. I would tend to use a DOAC even in the severely obese patient, but I would definitely get a trough level. I never do a peak level because that fluctuates from patient to patient at what time that is reached, but I would get a trough level. And my hope would be that the trough level is in the expected range and lets me sleep easier. If the level is lower than expected, then I'm more nervous and I don't quite know what I would do with it. You said you would switch then to a different anticoagulant, and that's perfectly appropriate. That's an individual decision then what I would do, but I would definitely not, well, I shouldn't say definitely, but I would not say, oh, let's use a higher dose of a DOAC.
Absolutely.
That I don't think has much behind it, and then risk for bleeding may also come in. It's a very individual decision in the severely obese patients.
I think so too. I think so. And I think you're right. There's no right answer here. And I also think it's really a conversation you need to have with your patient and really do a shared decision making and really outline kind of the challenges and limitations. And then also, you know, got to take into consideration the side effects of other drugs and all the limitations, you know, with warfarin.
So Rachel, let's talk about DVT prophylaxis dosing with the DOACs. So the patient with a BMR of 44.6 didn't have a clot, but is heavy, needs VT prophylaxis after hip or knee replacement or some other intervention. What kind of, would you use a DOAC and what dose would you use?
So I think for a BMI of 44, for a prophylaxis to prevent VTE, I would feel entirely comfortable using, again, rivaroxaban or apixaban at the standard prophylactic dose. So for rivaroxaban, that would be 10 milligrams a day. And for apixaban, that would be 2.5 milligrams twice a day.
Got it. Would that be different for you if the BMI was, let's say again, above 61 or so?
So I think that's a completely different story. And I would feel uncomfortable with just the prophylactic dose with a BMI greater than 60. And so in that patient, I would probably do Lovenox 40 milligrams twice a day, or I would consider, you know, Fondaparinux, but I would feel a little bit uncomfortable. Again, you know, completely arbitrary. I just don't know of evidence surrounding that. And I don't think there is a lot of evidence surrounding that. And so I'd feel pretty uncomfortable. How about you?
I think I would feel very similar. So we've talked about this BMI above 60 or so. Sometimes I'm even more nervous about using the DOACs at a BMI of 55 or so. That's still a pretty extreme body weight. We just have more experience with a enoxaparin, let's say 40 BID, which we use at my institution once a BMI is above 40. But I have to say, even with that, sometimes I wonder how well does it get absorbed in the severely obese patients. You mentioned fondaparinux, and the typical dose is 2.5 milligram once daily, and we don't have an adjustment for body weight. But I also do wonder, should you increase that to maybe 5 milligrams in the severely obese patient? The treatment is difficult, or the treatment decision is difficult. The DOAC use a standard dosing with a BMI between, let's say, 40 and 50, these severely obese patients, I'm okay with that. Once you get towards a BMI of 55 and above, I probably would feel more comfortable with a more established enoxaparin at the higher dose, the 40 milligram twice daily.
Yeah, so similar to me. And I would say, again, you know, the fondaparinux, that 2.5, again, you got to look at other risk factors. And if patients have significantly, you know, more risk factors than that, I might consider doing that. But that's our standard, you know, the 40 twice a day with a BMI over 40. That was a great discussion on using DOACs in obese patients. I'm wondering now if we can turn towards the patients who are undergoing bariatric surgery. And so, Stefan, what do the 2021 ISTH guidance say about use of DOACs after bariatric surgery? Can you share that with us?
Yeah, I will. And Rachel, before I do that, I want to show this slide here from a publication, which shows where the anticoagulants are absorbed. And it lists the different anticoagulants. And keep in mind that any of the anticoagulants are absorbed in the proximal small intestine, rivaroxaban even in the distal stomach, but everything else in the duodenum and the small intestine very proximally. So anything that changes the anatomy of the distal stomach and particularly the small intestine will lead to some disturbance of absorption of the anticoagulants. And that's true for warfarin as well. Obviously, this is only true for the oral anticoagulants. But even warfarin after bariatric surgery is very difficult. The transit time of the drugs is different, the meal size is different, the acidity is different, and then the absorptive surface is different. So keep that in mind. And this is true probably for any of the gastric bypass surgeries. And it depends on the center which one is done mostly and also the time practices change. There's a Roux-en-Y, which is depicted here on the left, the sleeve gastrectomy, the gastric banding, and then a more complex. But it all disturbs the anatomy of the upper intestine. And therefore, absorption of the DOACs and warfarin may be different. Now, the one thing that's interesting to keep in mind is, number one, rivaroxaban is also absorbed in the distal stomach, so that may be most sensitive to the disturbances after bariatric surgery. And the second thing to keep in mind is that apixaban is to some degree also absorbed in the more distal small intestine. So apixaban may be the preferred DOAC in patients after bariatric surgery. But I have to say, when I looked into this and tried to find our group information about where these drugs are absorbed, it's really difficult to find solid data on that to come to a really solid conclusion. So we've listed here in a publication on bariatric surgery and the DOAC use, number one, where the site of absorption is based on the limited published data. And then on the right-hand side in greenish, what do you expect is the anticipated effect of the surgical intervention? And look at apixaban, the first line. Gastric banding unlikely affects apixaban because the stomach itself is not affected. The small intestine is not affected. And with the others, possibly reduced absorption. So if somebody has had a bariatric surgery, my preference is, if I use a DOAC, apixaban and not rivaroxaban. Dabigatran and edoxaban, again, in the severely obese patients after these surgeries, has no data that I would even consider them. So the ISTH document from 2021 has the following comments on bariatric surgery. In the acute postoperative phase, for the first at least 4 weeks, use a parenteral anticoagulant. And the purpose is, if this patient who had a DVT or PE in the past needs full-dose anticoagulation after surgery, you don't know how it's absorbed. And therefore, let's use a parenteral anticoagulant, fenoparin or enoxaparin, or dalteparin for that matter, that we know the patient is absorbing it from the subcutaneous tissues. But then once a patient is 4 or more weeks after the bariatric surgery, and that could be 8 weeks, 12 weeks, once a patient has more adjusted to the different meal size, has recovered from the surgery, it's reasonable to consider switching to either warfarin or a DOAC for that matter. But if a DOAC is used, we don't know how well it's absorbed. And therefore, the committee suggested to do trough-level testing. Again, not peak, but trough-level to make sure it's roughly in the expected range. And then the same applies that we discussed earlier. If the level is below the expected range, and we do not take reference to that in the guidance document, but if it's below the expected range, And we wonder, what does that really mean? And what do we do now? Do we switch to warfarin, or do we switch back to parenteral anticoagulant, or does it just make us uneasy? I would not empirically increase the DOAC to a non-traditional dose.
First of all, Stefan, it's great to have this material out there because this question comes up a lot, and just having this guidance document has been so, so, so helpful. So thank you to you and the group. What anticoagulant you use in the following patient? Let's say there's a 43-year-old male, BMI of 49, is going to be undergoing gastric banding in 4 weeks. And he's currently on full-dose anticoagulation long-term with either rivaroxaban or apixaban. For a history of an unprovoked VTE, what anticoagulant would you use after the surgery?
So this patient needs full-dose anticoagulation. So I would use, based on the guidance document, which I fully stand behind, to use a parenteral anticoagulant for the first few weeks and then just rethink it at 4, 6, 8 weeks or so. And my preference is, and I don't have data for that, to use fenoxaparinux because it's once daily, but people are often more familiar with enoxaparin. So to use that twice daily at the appropriate dose would be what I would do. And then after a few weeks, it's reasonable to consider a switch to a DOAC. My preference would be to use apixaban because of the absorption even further down in the small intestine. I would use a traditional long-term dose, which in this case would be the 5 milligram BID. And I would do a trough level to make sure it's in the expected range. And Rachel, one thing if I may point out, sometimes see patients who are on a DOAC for DVT or PE in the past, and they did not volunteer that they had bariatric surgery in the past, or let's say they need to be started on an anticoagulant because they have a DVT PE and they had bariatric surgery 8 years ago and they don't think about it. So I tend to ask the patient, have you had bariatric surgery, quickly done, and then I know, got to be careful with the DOACs and consider what we just discussed.
That's a really, really good point. And I think as hematologists or anybody, any medical profession taking care of somebody with a VT, asking that background information is really important. Because a lot of times, if it's been a while ago, people are not going to share all that information, or they may not remember to. Well, this has been an incredible discussion with you, Stefan. And just to kind of summarize the guidance statements of use of DOACs in patients with obesity, as you've shared, in patients with a BMI up to 40 or weight up to 120, really using any DOAC is appropriate. I think for BMI greater than 40 or weight greater than 120, you have shared really great information that there's good data with rivaroxaban and apixaban for the treatment. There's also great data looking at rivaroxaban and apixaban for prevention. I think we've both talked about how there's just not enough data with dabigatran, edoxaban, or batrixaban in either those situations, VTE treatment or prevention. And then we also shared that it is completely appropriate to think of alternatives if necessary, vitamin K antagonists, weight-based lomelic white heparin, and fondaparinux. Although the guidance documents do not recommend checking peak and trough levels, we both talked about how we would check trough levels at certain BMI levels. You're probably comfortable above the 50, 60, probably same way, above 50 I would probably check. I think, and we also both talked about how we would check trough levels in patients after bariatric surgery. And then I think it's very clear that these direct oral anticoagulants, and in particular rivaroxaban and apixaban, should not be used in the acute setting after bariatric surgery, but it's entirely reasonable to think about their use after 4 weeks, and again, either one of those, and again, in checking trough levels. So I would say, although the 2021 updated guidance has removed obesity as a limitation to their use, some healthcare providers are still avoiding DOACs altogether in patients with any level of obesity. And I think there's still huge evidence gaps regarding the treatment of severe obesity, as we've discussed. I mean, we had differing opinions about the BMI greater than 60. I think there is still some gaps and challenges about thinking about the role of peak and trough levels. I think we both agreed we would check trough levels in some of these patients. The use of DOACs after bariatric surgery, which you so eloquently laid out for us, And then the appropriateness of DOAC dose reduction. I think we have very limited data on that for the secondary VTE prevention. So I still think there's a lot of challenges and gaps. I'm hoping that the information that Steph and I shared with you today will help providers feel more comfortable using direct oral anticoagulants in obese patients with VTE. I think both of these problems are healthcare crises, and the problems are going to continue, as I shared with you earlier. And I think having these drugs to use will be very helpful for our patients for many, many reasons. So I'd like to thank Stefan, you, for joining us. This has been a great discussion, and again, I really do hope that it educates providers and gives providers some confidence in using these drugs. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.